I thought I would go through the aspects of this, how we choose to be happy, these nine choices, and talk about them, and then do a little bit of a contemplation on them. So maybe not on all of them, but on the first few. And we'll be able to see how some of these have direct parallels in Buddhism, and some of them have direct parallels in the recovery path. And the good news about that is that if you're engaging in this kind of a process where you're trying to really cultivate more happiness in your life, that if you've been doing some of this work already, Buddhism or recovery or both, that you've already started. You're not starting from scratch on this. And I guess I'll just step back and say, well, this addresses this to some extent, but just to step back and say that the idea of kind of cultivating happiness can seem kind of trivial, like I should be more serious than that, and it can seem kind of new agey or self-helpy or something like that. I know as a kind of recovering cynic myself, you know, it took me a little bit of surrender to engage in this work. But what I came to see is that I was already making choices. And when you see these choices, you'll see what I mean. But I was making them more unconsciously. And that I do want to be happy. And not just for my own sake, but that if I'm going to function well in the world, if I'm going to be of service to others, if I'm going to be a parent and a partner, that being happy is going to support that. If I am unhappy, I'm not going to be of service to others. I came to see it not at all as a trivial activity or pursuit, if you'll pardon the reference. So we'll go through these nine choices that happy people make. One, intention, the active desire and commitment to be happy and the fully conscious decision to choose happiness over unhappiness. You know, and this is one of those things that when you hear it, you might think, well, don't I already want to be happy? But when we explore intention, we can often discover that that's not something that we've really been putting as a priority. So to say, this is a priority for me. I'm committed to being happy. And I'm consciously going to choose that. And that can really affect a lot of moment-by-moment choices and decisions we make. Am I going to go to this party because, you know, I think I should? Or and when I'm tired and I actually would like to go home, oh, I got to go out. You know, why am I doing this? You know, we ask ourselves, why are we doing things? And so much of the time we're not doing them because we want to. You know, we're doing them out of some sense of obligation. Two, accountability. The choice to create the life you want to live, to assume full personal responsibility for your actions, thoughts, and feelings, and the emphatic refusal to blame others for your own unhappiness. Not bad. No one else is to blame. Not your mommy and daddy. Not your boss. Not your partner. And this is another, connection with our practice. That we start to see how our thoughts, feelings arise, and how we are involved in feeding certain patterns of thought and emotion and behavior. It doesn't mean that other people don't affect us, but that we have to continue to make choices. That will be in our own interest. Three, identification. The ongoing process of looking deeply within yourself to assess what makes you uniquely happy, apart from what you're told by others should make you happy. When we've done this exercise in the Awakening Joy course, you just write down everything you can think of that makes you happy. And it can be everything from, you know, meditation to chocolate. You know, and everything in between, if there is anything in between. I'm not sure if there's anything in between. But, you know, and you kind of, you have to be kind of just non-judgmental as you do it, and just write everything down. And when I did this several years ago, one of the things that came up for me very strongly was, I want to play golf. And I'm embarrassed by that. You know, I thought, you know, you're supposed to be a Buddhist, you live in Berkeley, you're supposed to be cool, you know, a musician, you know, golf is for white old guys who are Republicans and wear, you know, white belts and white shoes. You know, when I was a kid, I played a lot of golf, and that I actually, we belonged to a country club. You know, I had a very privileged upbringing, which I threw away, but of course, it followed me. And when I was 16, and I was becoming a hippie and growing my hair, all the white Republicans got upset, and they kicked me off the golf course. So I was banned, you know. But of course, at that time, I was starting to become radicalized and drugized and hippieized. So I was like, you know, who wants to play golf anyway? But eventually, you know, as these things do, it came back. So when I turned 60, I got myself some golf clubs. And now I'm a complete golf addict. And you know, that's another problem I've got. But, you know, so we'll deal with that in the next lifetime. But you know, it's just one of those things like, this. I like doing this. And I find myself apologizing, as I am to you, about it often enough. But I spend a lot of time doing it. And then I'm not suggesting that you should play golf, although really, it's great exercise. It's actually a place of tremendous compassion. You know, when I first went out, I was embarrassed. I was like, oh, you know, I mean, I tried to practice. I took a couple lessons, and I went out to play. And just I was alone, so they hooked me up with a couple of guys, and I said to them, oh, you know, I'm not very good. And they're like, don't worry about it. And then you hit a bad shot, and everybody's like, oh, it's okay. You're still on the course. You know, don't worry. And, oh, you hit a good shot. Oh, nice shot. You know, and there's this real kind of compassion and mudita and, going on. It's a very, very sweet place, unless, of course, you're, you know, competing with each other, which I would never do. I compete with myself on the golf course. But it surprised me how much kindness there was in this place that I didn't realize. I mean, again, to me, that's looking for the good, right? This is one of the things about being happy, is to look for the good. So number four. So we've got intention, accountability, identification, and four is centrality, the non-negotiable insistence on making that which creates happiness central in your life. You know, it's not just that I've made this list and I've seen what I want to do, but I'm actually going to buy the golf clubs. And I'm actually going to go out and play every week. You know. This is a challenge. And many people, you know, this, now we're coming up against it, right? Because this isn't just talking the talk. This is walking the walk. You've got to do the stuff that makes you happy. And why aren't you doing the stuff that makes you happy? And, you know, we're not talking about that you have to spend a month in, you know, Guadalajara or something. You know, we're just saying, you know, take a walk because that makes you happy. Go to your yoga class. Call a friend. Have coffee with a friend. You know, whatever, what makes you happy, you know? You know, watch that cheesy sitcom. You know, fine. You know, it makes you happy. But do it. Do something. Do, and every day. We need to do something every day. James Barras suggests singing every day. And that's, singing is one of the great things about singing, besides the fact that, you know, it's joyful to just sing, is that the breathing involved in singing has a really positive effect on your body. You get a lot of oxygen, and it's very uplifting and energizing. So it's kind of a way to get endorphins running. Okay, number five, recasting, which I mentioned. The choice to convert problems into opportunities and challenges, and to transform trauma into something meaningful, important, and a source of social, of emotional energy. So the obvious example of this is something like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which was founded by the mother whose child was killed by a drunk driver. And there's a series of ads now on TV in the States of some parents holding up a text, and it's the text that their daughter was writing when she crashed the car, her car and died. You know, and it's, wow, I mean, this is the worst thing that can happen to a parent. The worst loss, I think, that can happen to any human being is their child dying. But to try to turn that into something positive. You know, if someone can turn that into something positive, then we can turn anything into something positive. Losing a job or losing a leg, you know, you can. This is what we have to do, and it takes us back again to accountability. We can't blame the world for our problems. We have to see, well, you know, I can't live a different life. This is the life I have right now. What am I going to do with it? You know, am I just going to say it's intolerable, or it's just I have to be this way, or is there something more I can make of it? You know, when I was working on this CD, I was approached by somebody who was in recovery and a Buddhist, putting quotes around that, and you'll understand why soon, who was a producer and a songwriter who's been very successful. He's had songs in a lot of big movies and owns a studio in San Francisco, and he offered to help me finish my CD. I'd done a lot of the tracking at home, laying down kind of the guitars and bass and vocals. So he came over with his laptop. He started to come over with his laptop, and he would transfer everything onto that and work with Pro Tools, which is the digital program they use in recording studios. And he was really making the stuff sound great. He was just really taking the music to another level. As we were working together, and I already knew this about him, I saw that he had this mean streak, shall I say, an anger issue. And he'd actually been through anger management, you know. And whenever I would mention some artist or someone, he would be like, oh, he's an asshole. And I kind of was like, I was putting this away, yeah, okay. You know, when you make the choice to try to overlook something like that, you usually bear the karmic consequences. So one day, when we were just about finished with the project, just a year ago, we had a disagreement, a creative disagreement. And because of how I expressed that, which was not the most skillful thing, he quit the project, took all the recordings. I didn't have copies of the master recordings. Took all I had was my home recording. So he took all these nearly completed recordings and said, you know, I'm going to destroy these. And if I ever hear any of them, because I had mixes of them. And he said, you know, if you try to release that, I'll sue you, you know. You know, it was a tremendous betrayal and a tremendous trauma for me, which took me a couple months to get over just emotionally. And I'm not over it. Because things like that, I'm not sure you ever get over. I mean, it was very, very painful for me. But first of all, I knew that I wasn't going to mean I was done. It wasn't like I was going to stop. I wasn't going to let that stop me. And So, you know, I went back to working on the recordings, and one of the things, he had contributed little parts to some of the songs, and so I had to take those out so that I would, you know, there wouldn't be any royalties going to him. And so then I rewrote the songs, and I was like, wow, this is better, you know? And then I started to realize, oh, you know, it was really good what he was bringing to it, but it wasn't really what I wanted it to be. It was kind of like he was kind of in control, and he had a certain ear for it that wasn't quite how I wanted it. It sounded great, but, you know, and there were all these things kind of getting added in. And after a while, I was like, this is better. I like this more the way it is now. And so that was, for me, a recasting. You know, I had to say, you know, I'm not going to, because I can listen to what he did now and go, it sounds great, and I'm glad I didn't release that. You know, that's not really who I was. Well, I think this is a really critical piece for us. Just as, and it goes back to the promises in AA, where it says we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We'll see how our past, our mistakes can benefit others. That's recasting, right? Our mistakes can benefit others. Okay, number six, options. The decision to approach life by creating multiple scenarios to be open to new possibilities and to adopt a flexible approach to life's journey. This is a tricky one. You know, we can really get the idea, this is what I want to do, this is who I am, and get locked in. And this is what I did. I mean, I use myself as an example of this because I'm the only person I know that well. But I'm sure many of you know, I've had experiences like this that, you know, I was going to be a musician. So I got myself locked into this path that for 20 years limited who I could be. You know, I dropped out of school. I didn't make, you know, I had a really narrow life, very limited life. I lived in poverty that entire time, for one thing. And I just didn't think I had any choices. I didn't think I could be anything else. And once I got sober and after a couple of years, I realized, wow, I can do other things. And when I went back to school, I was like, hey, I'm not dumb. You know, I can think. I'm interested. I'm enjoying algebra, you know. Geography is really interesting. Astronomy, wow, the stars. I never knew this. You know, and so it just felt like, wow, so freeing. And this comes back to that question about self and not self. When we have this locked-in idea of who we are, then the belief that we are a certain way conditions our actions. And then we create, our beliefs create our reality. So if we can undo some of those beliefs or just open up the possibility of other truths, then we can be something else. Once we believe we can only do one thing, that's all we'll do. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So look at what your beliefs are about yourself, about what your potential is, who you can be. Again, we can't all be astronauts and movie stars, but most of us, you know, after you look at your positive qualities, realize, well, you know, there's a lot of different things I could do. You know, I have these skills, abilities, intelligence. And as we age, you know, some options are taken away from us. So it's good to have some others that we can refer to, other things we would like to do. I mean, I can't go running. When I go running, my back goes into spasm and I'm crippled, you know. There's a lot of vigorous exercise I simply can't do. Playing golf, I go out and I walk for 4 hours, you know, and it feels really good. It's good exercise, but it doesn't traumatize my body in a way. So it's, you know, that's an option, right? It's a, because, I mean, a lot of us identify with certain, you know, aspects of our body and things that we can do. And when we lose those things, it's so important to find other ways to be healthy and to work with our bodies. 7, appreciation. The choice to appreciate deeply your life and the people in it, and to stay in the present by turning each experience into something precious. Just what we talked about with impermanence, and obviously what mindfulness is about. We don't usually talk about mindfulness so much as being about appreciation. But one of the things that mindfulness does is it amplifies our sense experience. It, and amplifies our heart's experience, our emotional experience, so that, even on a retreat, you walk outside and the world seems more alive. So I think we overlook somewhat, maybe we don't talk that much about how much mindfulness enriches our life. Being present and seeing. Literally, after my first retreat, when I went back to my hometown, I was looking around like, oh my God, I never realized what a beautiful town this is. I just had never really paid attention. Hadn't really seen it. So mindfulness really does improve the quality of our life, and naturally makes us appreciate what's happening in our lives. Number 8, giving. The choice to share yourself with friends and community and to give to the world at large without the expectation of a return. And of course, this is part of both these paths and every spiritual path, being of service, whether it's, volunteering to run the door at the workshop, or whether it's being a sponsor or helping kids, whether it's sharing our resources. Just such a freeing and enriching thing to do. And in the program, we just talk about getting out of ourselves by thinking about others. When you're focusing on other people, you're not thinking about your own feelings. I'm rarely depressed when I'm teaching. In between, I can. But it's very difficult for me to worry about myself when I'm sitting up here. Great relief. And 9, and the last, is truthfulness. The choice to be honest with yourself and others in an accountable manner by not allowing societal, corporate, or family demands to violate your internal contract. That's kind of beautiful. And this is sila, the Buddhist term for morality and ethics. The level of honesty and truthfulness that the 12-step world encourages is one of the things that really helped me move into true recovery. When I started to really open up and share at meetings, that's when it felt like I stepped into that world. And I found it so freeing to be able to talk about my shortcomings or my, my bad day or my bad feelings, whatever, in a community and share them. And obviously that has carried over into my Dharma teaching and what I'm committed to in my Dharma teaching is being honest and being truthful. And actually, when One Breath at a Time came out, there was one Dharma teacher who I was just in a social situation with who kind of looked at me askance and was like, well, your book is very self-revealing, isn't it? I thought, is there a problem with that? And it just sort of, I have a little resentment. I won't say that. Thank you. And I'll do some loving kindness for those who, I think that view here, sometimes Dharma teachers, I think, unintentionally, by being trying to be very impersonal and manifest and embody that aspect of the teachings, project an image of, if not perfection, like being really good. And I think that creates suffering. I know that I've taken on suffering when I compared myself to teachers who I thought were something different from me. They were uniquely good and I was uniquely bad or something. And then as I've gotten to know Dharma teachers more personally, it seemed to me that they were all actually human beings. So most of that kind of feeling has been dispelled, but part of my commitment as a teacher is to be honest about my failings, I think my success as a human being is somewhat evident. You know, I've been in recovery all these years. You know, I've got some wisdom. I've got some talent. You know, those things are sort of obvious. And I'm proud of those things and happy about having those qualities that I've been able to express. But I'm also still a human being who is subject to the First Noble Truth. And if I just project the positive, then people just are in this role of feeling less than. And it's just a very common thing that, I mean, you know, people think, oh, well, you know, when you're meditating, you know, you're like in this some perfect state, you know, and I'm just sitting here spacing out. So, no, we're all sitting here spacing out, you know. I'm just spacing out better than you, you know. I have no idea what that means. So, truthfulness. Okay. So let's do one more contemplation using the first few of these choices.
What's the difference between a contemplation and a meditation?
The difference between the way I view a difference between a contemplation and a meditation is that a meditation is, kids, do you hold it down back there? The simplest terms to me, in meditation we're trying to empty the mind. Let go. In contemplation, we are trying to deeply reflect upon some spiritual question. So the classic contemplation is, who am I? And, you know, typically it's, you know, you just keep asking the question, who am I? And then you come up with an answer, and then you ask it again, who am I? And you keep trying to kind of dig down. The way I present contemplations, they're a bit more like just thinking about something, but trying to think about it in a very careful and intentional way so that you use the element of meditation that you use is the element of coming back. When you find yourself kind of digressing and getting lost, you just come back to, wait, what's this question? Doesn't look like I explained that sufficiently. Okay. All right, settling back into your body again. Maybe we could do an Okay. Intention. Making the choice of intention. This requires both the strong desire to be happy and the commitment to take action. It is the fully conscious decision to choose happiness over unhappiness. Ask yourself, do you actively intend to be happy? It can be something of a shock to realize that we don't have a clearly defined goal of happiness. Maybe we think it's too trivial, or that it's more important to give than to receive. Ultimately, we find that setting the intention for happiness takes nothing away from others, but in fact allows us to give more. Consider your essential intentions in your life and make a commitment to happiness. Accountability. This is the choice to assume full personal responsibility for your actions, thoughts, and feelings, and the emphatic refusal to blame others for your own unhappiness. It is the insistence on seeing yourself as having control over your own life rather than being at the receiving end of circumstance. Do you assume personal responsibility for your life? Accountability is completely compatible with 12-step principles. When we become accountable, we are no longer victims. We see how much power we actually have, and we begin to use it. Of course, we can't control everything, but if we are honest, we see how much we can affect our own happiness. Look at how you blame people, things, and situations for your unhappiness, and consider what power you have to change your life. Identification. This is the ongoing process of looking deeply within yourself to assess what makes you uniquely happy, apart from what you're told by others should make you happy. As you go through your days, begin to ask yourself which choice or direction will truly make me happiest. Reflect on the things that make you happy, from the trivial to the grand. Don't leave out anything, no matter how you think it makes you look. Centrality. This is the non-negotiable insistence on making that which creates happiness central in your life. Happy people don't wait to retire or put off that which gives them the greatest joy. Do you centralize happiness in your life? Make a commitment to do two things every day that are on your list of things that make you happy. And now coming back to the breath. back into the body. Seeing that happiness is available here and now, and just by being present with what is. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, present moment, wonderful moment. When we are present to this moment, we see the wonder. Sometimes we don't have to do anything to create happiness except be present. It's easy to fall into the trap that happiness is in the future and requires something different from what we have now. In the future, we will see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and think. Just as in the present, we are seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking. This is all there is to our lives, these six sense experiences. Nothing more and nothing less. It's within these experiences that we must find happiness. And finally, we must ask ourselves, what is happiness? It's not necessarily some elevated state, some bliss, some excitement. The Buddha says that the highest happiness is peace, the peace of nirvana. To touch the stillness within us is happiness. To know that we are living wisely is happiness. To express our own kindness is happiness. A job well done is happiness.